Iars da wan y bari, gisting o'r hone, a'r gintris war bibrn am zil cwn o stone. Yd muslar had ba hol, it was by me tamin, at ba mis look was e pit to drive in. Jowd and maud vrem merchieta was e loc, zid vabrin and...
Can you imagine a 25-foot wall of water and that mass? A building has got no chance. People have got no chance. I mean, when you glance back at it, it's actually mind-blowing. It's hard to imagine that people actually lived out here.
My name is Shane. I've lived all over, but I was raised in Wexford town, in the southeast of Ireland, and I feel a strong sense of kinship with that place. I am, more than anything else, a Wexfordian. It has influenced who I am, how I think, and how I interpret the world around me. Eola, and the story of the Eoles, who they were and where they went, is sort of like a missing piece of that jigsaw puzzle. Eola began to weave its spell on me when I was around 9 years old. It was the 80s and money was tight, so our school tour that year involved a trip around the county, visiting historical sites. I think it must have been on that trip that I first heard about these strange people and this language that was spoken here in Wexford and nowhere else. Maybe the notion kind of cast a spell on me. It has on others too. Dermot O'Murrahy is a Wexford-born academic who has spent his life studying Eola.
After the Norman invasion of 1169, some of the adventurers who accompanied the expedition of Strongbow, Fitzstephen and Maurice Fitzgerald settled in lands assigned to them in the southeast corner of Wexford, in a district now known as the Baronies of Forth and Bargy. It may be assumed that some of these adventurers were infantrymen in the service of Fitzstephen and Maurice de Prendergast, the two knights on whom Diarmuid MacMurrough conferred the baronies, and that there were Normans, Flemings, Welsh and English among them. During the century following the invasion, their numbers were augmented by other followers of the Norman knights, and it's a simple historical fact that their descendants still inhabit the same corner of Wexford, a triangle of land between Wexford Town, Banno Bay and Cairnsore Point, where names such as Parle, Cod, Stafford, Devericks, Lambert, Roach, Rossiter and Brown still predominate.
My name is Nicholas Furlong. I'm generally spoken of as Nicky Furlong, and I'm a writer and historian. Well, Eola is a dialect which was in use in the geographically separated from Wexford two baronies or districts called Forth and Bargy in the very southeast corner of the southeast corner of Ireland. And it's a geographic entity because the long, low hills called the Mountain of Forth, stretching somewhat from Wexford town to Kilmore, would, before the arrival of the railways, have made it a complete isolated place. It's always been regarded in the old Gaelic Confederation of Kingdoms period to be separate from the Irish political situation, in that the Irish name is Fort Tuatha Mora, the land of the stranger people by the sea.
The people of Forth and Bargy remain a people apart. They have a distinct dress, a significant physical swarthiness and darkness of eye, and their dialect, clearly an alien tongue, made them the subject of ridicule and suspicion.
Jacob Poole was a Quaker farmer who lived in Growtown in Timon in Wexford. He died in 1827, aged 53. The story goes that one day he was riding into town to do some business and came across a group of very strangely dressed people, obviously praying and saying mass in a muddy field, worshipping in an odd language. He was disgusted to see them kneeling on the ground in the mud, and the next day visited the local priest and offered to pay for a proper church to be built for them. This began a relationship and fascination with the Eoles for Jacob Poole, who wrote the only glossary of their dialect.
Eola is beset by protagonists in the form of the local Gaelic, spoken by many of the local populace, and also by a decaying form of English, scarcely recognisable to that spoken in Britain, but an errant child of that mother tongue nonetheless. Words of Eola appear in both the Irish and English spoken in Wexford, and I fear words of Irish and English seem to appear in Eola likewise.
Celestine Murphy is an historian who works for the Wexford Library Service. She is a direct descendant of Eoles from the Piercestown area of Wexford, and her grandmother still used a lot of Eola in her daily speech.
For example, she would say, "Kirky down," to stoop down.
Kirky down.
Kirky down, yeah.
Right.
And there are other ones too. The bow, of course.
That's a Eola term
for the banshee.
Yeah. Right, because I grew up hearing a lot about the bow as well. I just assumed, I never tallied it with the banshee. I assumed it was kind of a ghoul or something, you know, but I suppose that's what the banshee was.
Mm-hmm. I recall clearly myself, and in fact there would be words I would use myself, you know, in everyday speech that would be clearly understood here. For example, I would say, I'm going to sock it out this afternoon, S-A-W-K. That means I'm going to do nothing. I'm going to, you know, take a rest. Another word, which is quite frequent, is take your steven. Did you ever hear that?
I did not ever hear
that. Take your steven down here means take it easy, you know. But the another one, which is quite common, even to this day, is if you go into a pub and ask for a chai of whiskey. A chai is a small portion, therefore a half one. Chai.
When you got a little bit older and mm-hmm. started becoming interested in sort of history and the history of the area, mm-hmm. did that give you a deeper appreciation of this, or what was your sense of your own heritage?
Well, yes, it did. I mean, my mother had in herself a great sense of living in that particular part of the county, of living in Piercestown, which is, you know, very sort of Forth and Bargy-ish, that kind of area.
The people of Forth and Bargy, whilst living in the main in harsh circumstances, are prone to come together, particularly on feast days or at fairs, to dance, sing, and generally cast off the vagaries of life. They have a wealth of songs in their own tongue, celebrating all manner of customs and games, but also a good deal of pious, spiritual, and holy melodies.
Good people all, this Christmas time, consider well and bear in mind what our good God for us has done in sending his beloved Son. With Mary holy we should pray to God with love this Christmas day. In Bethlehem upon that morn, there was a blessed Messiah born.
The Wexford Carol is a perfect example of folk transmission. Through being handed down from father to son over time, many hundreds of years, almost no Eola is left in the carol. Jacob Poole, however, had the foresight to record the lyrics of Eola folk songs, such as the one heard at the start of this programme, though sadly almost no one sings them anymore. Mumming is another example of Eola customs from the early medieval period.
Your attention pay, kind friends, and please listen for a while until I relate the heroic deeds of these boys from Erin's Isle. 12 patriots we represent, who nobly fought to right a country's wrongs. We've an exiled saint and a soldier priest, gallant warriors and kings brave and strong. The first I am, the captain bold, who leads this rebel throng. I've a chosen band of heroes grand. To Rattangan, County Wexford, we do belong. Who once provoked our state, left Erin's shore, ne'er saw it more.
Well, my name is Graham Carty. I'm from Little Greig in Duncormac here in County Wexford, about 5 miles over the road from here.
Well, we saw your group marching into the hall and kind of lined up, and then you performed your poem. How did you choose those, or was that poem laid down to you, or where did that come from?
That particular rhyme now would be the rhyme that would be most familiar to sets in this area. Going back and talking to my uncle now, my grandfather, talking to those in days gone by, we would have been talking about older rhymes. Like they would have been more serious. Or you might notice when I was calling out the names, I was saying, like, here next we have St. Colum Kill, once provoked their state, left there in shore, and there saw it more, whilst he will or lay it. And at that stage, each individual would step up and have their individual say on each thing. So I was really introducing individual items, and each person stepped in and gave their piece. But that has died away, and we just have the one main rhyme at the moment.
Okay.
Since a very early age, like, the moment was very important. Like, it was actually a... I suppose a very much talked about thing, like Sunday mornings, like it was a serious topic, like, and it was a certain grade you had to be at, and probably before my time, like, it was a lot more serious, but definitely it was a very important thing to have in having your lifetime in this area anyway.
It all began for me with the island. I remember seeing it for the first time on that school tour as evening rolled in and the rain came down.
Start up, shall we?
It was almost completely underwater, a piece of silt, virtually submerged, roofs and gables protruding above the waves like ghost ships. The Yoles, the last of them, went there to live because the people who ran the port of Rosslare needed their skills as pilots to help the sailors direct the boats in. It was as inhospitable and barren a place as you could find. They lived there almost as hunter-gatherers, scraping a living from the sea and the salt marshes. Industry and commerce sent them there, and using nature as their weapon, industry and commerce killed them. Anthony Coon is an adopted Wexford man, with a keen knowledge of the coastline and the history of the harbour. He took me out to see the island, or what's left of it.
What you're seeing here essentially is the remains of three buildings. Further down the other side, on an extremely low tide, you can actually see the ruins of a wall. And I'm told that was a garden wall.
Somebody's house.
Yeah.
And this was, you were saying this was an island. There was about 700 families here at one point.
50 houses.
Yeah.
750 acres of ground.
Right.
That pole that's up there, on the ruins, that pole, I would guess, is about 30 feet. That's a danger mark. I've actually experienced weather out here that there have been waves and swells that are higher than that pole. So when somebody says to me that just got washed away in a storm in 1925, it's not a far-fetched story.
What was the thing that... I mean, we're looking at a village there that is now effectively underwater.
Yeah.
I mean, what caused that to happen? I mean, it must have been more than just a storm.
An extremely bad storm. I'm told that it was a huge storm and it just annihilated the whole lot.
Yeah.
Now, you know, of recent, we've had some freak conditions. So it's very believable that there was a freak storm that just took it. I mean, believe you me, this is what you're experiencing here today. This is like a lake. This is calm. This is nothing compared to what I've actually experienced out here myself and what this boat has been through out here. This is nothing. And when you see... You saw when we were out there, you know, a few little waves, and you could imagine like a 2-foot wall of water hitting the three of you up on the bow of the boat here. It'll be quite sore. Can you imagine a 25-foot wall of water and that mass? A building has got no chance. People have got no chance. I mean, it's When you glance back at it, it's actually mind-blowing. It's hard to imagine that people actually lived out here.
And we're talking about a community with kids as well. There would have been children there?
School and graveyard.
School and graveyard. Yeah. And do we have any idea how many kids there were? Or?
No, I'm told that there was approximately about 70 families. Because in those days, there would have been more than one family in one house. There's about 70 families out here. And I'd say in those days, there could have been 4, 5, 6, possibly even more children per family. So there was quite a sizable community.
A lot of the Yola words describe now technical fishing words and technical farming words that you would not hear anywhere else. Outside Wexford, for example, a pitchfork, a four-tagged fork, is known as a fork, but here it's known as a sprung. Now, it may not necessarily be exclusive to the barony of Forth, but they would not know anywhere else in Ireland what you're talking about.
Well, a couple of things are occurring to me as I listen to you talk, Nicky. One of them is that the language, as I hear you say those words, it's quite onomatopoeic.
Yes.
Isn't it? It's quite, you can almost hear the meanings. It's an expressive, a terribly expressive language.
Oh, yes.
Must have been very vibrant when it was alive, when people were conversing with one another.
Yes.
It speaks of the landscape. It speaks of the work that the people were doing. It speaks almost of the life, which must have been harsh.
Yes. But I also think the accent that was used is even more telling and much more difficult. It must have been in those days, because there is an accent down in the region of Bridgetown, the Moor of Mulrankin, Murntown around there, which is quite extraordinarily expressive in the use of vowels and so on like that, which is fascinating. But then, of course, remember that Wexford town is the headquarters and the top capital town of the Barony of Forth. And the Wexford accent itself, the inside internal Wexford, is quite unique. There's nothing like it in Ireland. I'd hate to see it ever dying down because
it's distinctive.
Yeah. We would have come on the tours.
We're in search of Yola. We're trying to find it,
yes,
in a way. Now I know you have some opinions as to where it might be. We're heading over to England looking for any little pockets where there may be people who are speaking something that might be similar to what Yola might have been. Where would you look if you had to go to find it?
Oh, well, if something similar, it is said that quite a lot of the mixture of the Irish language in with the Yola dialect is Chaucerian English, which Chaucerian English would be different a lot from the English we speak today. It would have been, I suppose, a relation of Saxon, German, and in Cornwall is fascinating. The early Christian missionary who came and more or less conquered the pre-Christian centre on the exact point of Cairnsore, where there was so much marine disasters, in order, as they say, to placate the demon. The legend down there is that this Saint Vauk came across to Ireland floating or sailing on a rock. Now, that may sound improbable, but usually when you get a myth corroborated by another myth, you've got to pay attention. And I was in Cornwall 10 years ago, and I've forgotten the name of the little port village that I went down to. And I discovered to my astonishment that there was a Saint Vauk there too. And the legend about him in Cornwall was that he came across to County Wexford floating on a rock. We had never heard of it, but beyond the fact that it was from Cornwall that Saint Vauk used to come on his rock, not England, Cornwall.
We need to make that distinction very clear.
Very clear, yes.
I knew we had to go further afield. The Olds came to Ireland with the Normans, which meant that they had to come from somewhere. and they brought Yola and all their customs and traditions with them. I wondered if there was a place where Yola was still spoken in some form or other. Could it be revived? And if we could find it, would we find the sort of interplay between it and the indigenous languages of its home, as we had found in Wexford? I travelled with my friend Richie O'Hara, a native Irish speaker with an interest in Yola.
Okay, so next stop, Weymouth. So Shane, what are we looking for here in Dorset?
In a way, I suppose we're looking for the holy grail of the Yola story, which is amid all of the marginalisation and poverty and betrayal that we've encountered so far, what we're looking for is somebody who is alive and who is speaking and communicating in a language or a dialect that is something like Yola on a regular basis. So we're really looking for somewhere where Yola survived, because it was so effectively wiped out in Wexford. Where did the olds go?
Judith Shane, nice to meet you.
William Barnes was in some ways the English equivalent of Jacob Poole. He was a poet, a teacher, a minister and a contemporary of Poole's. And he was hugely responsible for popularising and preserving the Dorset dialect. He wrote over 800 poems, many in that dialect, which are proudly celebrated today by local folk musicians.
I've been looking at the book there that has some of his poetry and everything in it. It's the Dorset dialect seems to be, it seems to have more English in it than Yola, which would have been the dialect in Wexford, where we're from.
Yeah.
That seems to, what we've seen of it, it comes across as much more like a foreign language almost than the dialect here, which to reading it is you can kind of understand.
When Barnes was born in 1801, he was born in Sturminster Newton, which is in North Dorset, as far north as you can go really in Dorset. And at that time, you would have been able to tell the difference between somebody who came from Sturminster Newton and somebody who came from Dorchester, whereby their dialect. So that of course has changed completely now. And when Barnes wrote his dialect poetry, he started off writing it with a lot of phonetic spelling, which he toned down gradually over the years when he realised it wasn't all that popular. And it did make it more difficult, though it didn't seem so to him. But I think that is a difficulty now. Well, there's a reason people don't read his poetry as much as they should do, because he wrote some very fine poems, is because they're put off by the phonetic spelling as much as anything. And in fact, some of it, like comic phonetic spelling that you get in Shaw or somebody, isn't necessary. It's how you would say the word anyway in any form of English. But I think it was quite difficult to understand, but now it has vanished, so there's no way of telling, really, and because all you've got is what he wrote down, which is a poet's impression, and he may have taken a lot of liberties.
Fippinock for Diggins. Yours work, my lads, a gwine on. I never heard the lick. They say at Fippinock for there's gold in every crick. And more than that, they'd say there's lots of coal and iron. And 'twon't be long afore we'd a get a little cheaper viren. A man told I for certain true he digged a little while and digged up lots and lots of gold. Lord, how he made I smile. I went straight wum so glad's a bird, and all the time kept humming the zong a zongs I'd a love so well. I mean, the good times are coming.
Tim Laycock is one of the foremost musicians and proponents of Dorset folk music and history. He draws many parallels between the lives of the Yoles and the speakers of the Dorset dialect.
I would say it was a very hard life. You know, they were basically living off the land. Most of them were effectively at that time subsistence farmers. They had very little apart from what they made themselves, and that goes as far as the entertainment as well. The accent at the time was very broad. I mean, they took a great pride in it, I think. I think the speech was quite slow, full of colour. if people do a kind of parody of West Country speech, it's all ooh, ah, and lots of Z's on the end of things and R's and that kind of sound. But that R sound is a very important part of it.
Right, we're on Bulbar Hill.
Near,
read it out there, Richie.
We're on Bulbarrow Hill in Oakford, Fitzpaine.
Which, according to our sources, is pretty much the heart of very, very rural Dorset. This is where the last of the Dorset dialect was really spoken. And what has been really remarkable is we were given a copy of a very, very rare book, William Barnes. It's not just a copy of William Barnes' version of Jacob Poole's glossary, but there's also introductions and observations here from Hoare, who's a great Wexford historian, and there's a whole conglomeration of stuff in here, different information, which is really confirming a lot of the theories that we had sort of really been sort of formulating ourselves as we've been going around. You know, for example, Jacob Poole had commented on the fact that you really could recognise the physical differences in the Yoles, that these were people who actually looked considerably different. And he talks about the fact that they had, you know, distinctive Roman noses, dark hair, very dark eyes, the way that they dressed, they had their own particular costume. This is what we're discovering. It's kind of like everything is in a way falling into place.
Well, the only thing I would suggest now is that we'd hit the road to Cornwall. I know it's lovely here, but
we might find something
there. We might find something there.
Cornish, though very different in sound to Yola, has experienced a huge resurgence in recent years, and there are some striking similarities between the Cornish and the Yoles in terms of personality, custom and history. Jennifer Lowe and her colleague Paul Hodge run the Cornish Development Partnership. We know that the Cornish people are of Celtic origin. We know that there is a strong sense of separateness from maybe mainstream English culture. So who were the Cornish people? Where did they come from?
Well, they were the British that were there before the Saxon invasions. And so
Celts.
Celts, who were then pushed into the western regions. So you've got the separation into Welsh and Cornish, and then migrations from Cornwall to Brittany gave you Breton. So you've actually got Welsh, Cornish, Breton inextricably linked, and they all come from the Celts before the Anglo-Saxon conquest,
so
originally.
Did the Roman invasion have much impact on the Cornish people? Were the Romans here particularly?
No, not much. A little bit trading, but other than that, it's sort of from Exeter. Exeter's almost the furthest west, isn't it?
Yeah, the first Roman place name, Cester, is actually Exeter. But the Romans did trade tin in the west of Cornwall, but it just wasn't worth occupying in a great long peninsula from Exeter all the way down, you know, peopled by, nutters in hill forts that would fight to the death. Better to trade with them.
Yeah.
So some of the earliest Cornish we've got is actually manumissions of slaves, where you find that the names of the... In a gospel book. So you find that the names of the slaves are nearly all Cornish, and the names of the landowners are English, so you've got the Anglo-Saxon and the Celtic.
So that would make sense in terms of our group coming over, who are effectively a slave class being brought over to work for the Normans. So there's a parallel there.
That makes it. But linguistically, that class would have been Celtic, not English speaking, for the most part.
Okay. But the big connection is the sort of exchange of saints, because the British gave you Patrick.
Yes.
Or Cothraca, and for us in Cornwall, one of our patron saints is Ciaran, or we call him Piran. Mm. So you've got that PQ thing. Yeah. So we sort of, fair exchange is no robbery.
Why wouldn't it? Yeah.
But one patron saint for another.
Yeah.
Do you feel that Cornish is closer to Welsh, or what Celtic language would you feel it bears its closest similarity to?
Breton.
Oh, yes.
It's closest to Breton. Slightly more distant from Welsh, and more distant again then from the Gaelic languages. But I think that history bears that out, because the most recent division was Cornish and Breton, and you divided from Welsh just a bit before that, you know, by geography and everything else.
But if you learn,
I mean, I speak Welsh as well, and I mean, you can sort of go from one to the other quite easily. And a Cornish speaker can look at, or Breton speaker can listen to Cornish, definitely. And other than the accent, which is very different, you know, you can work it out.
Can you count to 10 in Irish for me?
Yeah. Last time I could, anyway. Hien, do, tri, cahir, cuig, she, shacht, ocht, nui, de.
Onan, dew, tri, peswar, pimp, chweich, saith, eighth, now, deig.
Yeah, there are definite similarities
there.
It also shows the PQ thing, because if you look at cuig and pimp, you've got that in a nutshell, you know, that sort of the CG and the P.
Are there things like, I mean, the Breton pipes are very similar to the Irish Illan pipes. Does Cornwall have its own set of traditional instruments or things
we
like that?
We do. The Cornish pipes were reconstructed from carvings, and actually Merv reconstructed them. They're very similar, but they have a double chanter.
Oh.
A sort of interesting style of pipes. Not terribly easy to chew. But then, yeah, so yeah, we do. And of course, it's been cross fertilisation too.
The trip to Cornwall revealed one remarkable similarity after another. The Cornish pipes, a bellows-driven instrument that sounded like a close relative to the Illan pipes, had gone extinct, but Cornish musicologist Merv Davey had reconstructed them. He lived in a breathtakingly beautiful village in the depths of the Cornish countryside.
What happened in Cornwall is that we're a bit cantankerous down here, you see. You know, we all do a bit different. You've heard that. We all do things a bit differently. So when they had the kind of Reformation throughout the UK, we dug our heels in. So all the diddly-diddly carols that they used to sing that were very jolly were replaced by more austere and more serious carols and songs than that. And we hung on to ours. You're talking about a mixture of the Reformation and going on from that with a more Puritan attitude towards religion, where you weren't allowed to have idols and so on in the church, and the church were painted in drab colours and that. And what we did, we hung on to our carols. So that when it came to the 1800s, 1823 to be exact, they were still around. And there was a chap called Davis Gilbert who collected all these old medieval carols. And of course, they're all 6-8 dance tunes. So we actually have got these little tunes, and which could well be have been the old tunes that were played in medieval times.
You've just provided a massive link between Cornwall and Yola.
Well, there we are.
Because one of the lasting Yola folk relics are a series of incredibly dark, austere carols handed down from father to son from the medieval period, which we call the Wexford Carols. And there we had it, like a whisper from somewhere very close by. There is a cycle of Cornish carols, just like the cycle of Wexford carols. Some of the melodies are even the same. John Kirby is an historian who specialises in the day-to-day lives of the Cornish people. I wanted to know more about the innate and quite famous Cornish stubbornness and how this might have affected their lives and fate, just as it had affected the Yoles.
You haven't got people travelling through Cornwall a lot in history. Probably more in the past, somewhere like Penryn in about the 1400s, it was said there were more foreigners here than Cornish people. But certainly the way you just described these other people sounds very much like the Cornish. They can be stubborn and they hold on to their own things, you know, like their language and their culture, and they don't like it being changed. So if you had a group even more isolated, I could see that they would, you know, not want to change their traditions.
Another thing that we found that is quite similar is that our Yoles were originally a slave group, a serf group that were brought in to do the hard labour, really, in kind of taming the Wexford countryside, as that when the Normans were given their lands by Dermot McMurrah. And I believe that the Cornish people around the time of the Norman invasion here would have been a similar slave-type group. That tends to leave its mark, doesn't it, a kind of indelibly on the psyche of a people.
Well, I'm an Englishman, and I'm continually reminded of it down here.
Really?
That I've come from a different country, not a different county, a different country. So it goes back a long way. I mean, they do feel different, and they are different. I mean, I think you can still see, you know, shorter, darker people, which goes right back to the Roman period when the original Anglo-Saxons, the original people here, were driven further and further west.
They are a stoic people, slow to anger, happy in their work, pleasing of countenance, and peaceful in their communities. It pains me that they have become so marginalised and peripheral among the people of Wexford, and that poverty and deprivation have encroached upon them so. There is much that could be learned from them if time were taken for the endeavour. I fear that if they are not cherished now, their customs and manners may vanish altogether.
One of the things I've asked myself more than anything else over the last few weeks and months is, what did we learn from this experience? We went in search of the Yoles, and I have to ask myself, did we find them? Well, I think we did, and the thing that strikes me more than anything else, and the thing that I'm really grateful for, is that I now have a sense of the Yoles as a living, breathing real community who lived their lives and dealt with the adversities and obstacles that this particular environment and indeed the times that they lived in placed in their way, and they did so with remarkable good humour. We didn't find a living person who speaks their language, and in fact we don't really know what it would have sounded like, but what we do have is, and I think that this is really valuable, is that we have the cultural artefacts, the songs, the experiences, the customs that they left behind. And for me, the Yoles live through those more than through anything else.
Matwal or boost high soon was e tight at Arderoon was var aiming angish e height. Zich vizin tar vizin tell the one airs e nor zichil nar well now nor ne'er me. To break up a bates we had a poosty. Tommin was loose, and so was a barry. Our heart cam tore out, and so volley green. The happen he heard, and he cry was, Tommin.